Hello, everyone. Andrew here with some breaking news before we get into the episode proper. The much-anticipated Club WPT Gold is now in beta, which means it is not open to the general public, but it is open to select players, and those select players happen to include people who have signed up or who do sign up using our affiliate code THINK, THINK. So if you go to clubwptgold.com and sign up with the code THINK, THINK, you will be able to start playing right away. And there are going to be opportunities to play with Carlos and me. We are planning a meetup game at the Cash Game Tables on January 25th and also a home game tournament on the 1st, which means it'll be only for people who use our password, which also is THINK, T-H-I-N-K. So for that home game tournament, you have to both sign up for the site using the affiliate code THINK, and then also in order to join the home game tournament, the password for that will be THINK. Both of those will be at 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific. So that's the meetup game on Saturday the 25th, and then the home game tournament on February the 1st. I will try to get more details. This is all still very new to us as well in terms of like exactly how this works and how you will find us. So I just wanted to give you those dates now. For updated information, following Thinking Poker on either Twitter or Blue Sky will be the best place to get up-to-date information. But if there are more relevant details in terms of like how exactly to find us on there and participate in those games, I will try to get them in here on the podcast feed as well. Maybe just put out a quick little announcement, you know, in Thursday or Friday if we have more details then. But you can mark your calendars for the meetup game on the 25th at 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific. Also, the home game tournament on February 1st. You can play with both Carlos and me then. This, by the way, is, I believe the beta is only for America right now. So ultimately, the site will serve much of Canada as well. I don't believe Canadians are currently able to play in the beta, even if they do have our code, unfortunately. But if you are in one of the participating states, which is most states in the United States, and you sign up with that code, you should be able to play in the beta and play with us in those games. Enjoy the show.
Danger is stealing in as relapse sums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day when you give in. Give in. Give in. Give in.
Hello and welcome to episode 460 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Catonsville, Maryland, I am Andrew Brokus. I will be joined shortly by Carlos Welch in Las Vegas, Nevada, and by Matt Matros in Brooklyn, New York. Our guest Matt is a longtime professional poker player and author. You may know him from his previous appearances on this show, episode 301, episode 379, and episode 425. We are once again starting off the new year with Matt. He's got a new book out, 24 No Limit Hold'em Tournament Hands from 2024, a year of daring bluffs and nitty folds. We've talked to Matt a bunch before about his career and his story, so this episode is really just one long strategy segment with him, Carlos, and me. We'll get right into that in just a moment, but I've got a few things to tell you first. The biggest news is that Club WPT Gold will be launching soon. This is the first major new online poker site to open in the United States, most of the United States anyway, in quite some time. And Carlos and I are both really excited about it. You can join us at clubwptgold.com and use signup code THINK, that's T-H-I-N-K, as in thinking poker, when you register. If you would like more poker strategy from Carlos and me, the place to get that is patreon.com/thinkingpokerdaily. It's now completely free to join. You'll get two episodes from our archive every week, and then you'll have the option to upgrade to get three or five new episodes each week as well. Finally, you can support us when you subscribe to GTO Wizard. Sign up at gtow.pro/thinkingpoker. We'll have links for all of that in the show notes as well. Now here's our interview with Matt Matros. Happy New Year, Matt Matros.
Happy New Year, Andrew.
I think we kicked off 2024 with you were our first guest of 2024 as well.
I just got to keep writing short books at the end of every year, so I get to be the first podcast guest every New Year.
I was thinking maybe I'll try to put out 25 hands from 2025 and get it out ahead of you. And
oh, you'll steal my thunder. We should put them out together. We should create a joint 25 hands.
Or I'll put out 26 hands from 2025 and one up you.
That would do it.
This is just the second in that series?
Yeah, I had this idea for the first time last year in 2023. And I'd say this year, it came together a bit easier because last year I just sort of had the idea and had to figure out all the hands and figure out what I wanted the book to look like in 2023. And in 2024, even though I wasn't consciously working on the book for most of the year, I sort of knew I would want to do it at the end of the year. So I would occasionally keep a hand knowing I was going to use it at the end. I knew how I was going to organize by theme. So I kind of had in the back of my mind, what themes do I want to bring into the book? And so when I sat down to work on the book, it came together a lot quicker. Not that 2023 I spent a ton of time. Both books came together remarkably quickly. They're very short as well. They're more like booklets than books. But this one, because I had it in my mind all year that I was going to do it, the project itself wasn't quite as cumbersome as the previous one.
Yeah, I have gotten, or you know, when I was playing more live poker, was in the habit of just kind of recording any remotely interesting hand that I played, often for the purpose of reviewing it myself, but just between podcasts and videos and potential books, I was like, I could always find a use for, you know, just like useful to have a like folder of hands where you're anytime that you need an example for something, you can just sort of dig through there and look for some inspiration.
Yeah, absolutely. Whenever you're in the either poker content or even poker instruction, or even just if you want to review it for yourself as a player, it's really important to record a lot of your hands. But it's also, if you know you have this project at the end of the year, it's also nice to just kind of have them, okay, I'm keeping this for months from now. I know I'm going to come back to it. That's kind of it. That was where the difference was for me. But yes, I send my hands to my students all the time. It's kind of one of the teaching techniques that I really like. And that was kind of why I wanted to do the books this way in the first place.
Oh yeah, that's a good idea too. Just sending them to students. We've also joked about podcast equity, which is when you fuck up a hand, you at least get podcast equity out of it. And we're like, okay, well, at least I'll have something to talk about on the show.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Is there anything that you would point to as like distinctive in this book, kind of like things that you were particularly aware of learning or being focused on in 2024 in your poker journey?
Sure. Well, so there's four sections in the book. There's a section on barreling, meaning betting the turn after following up a flop bet with a bet on the turn. And there's a section at the end about ICM adjustments, and then the two middle sections are about pulling off big bluffs and also calling your opponents, whether or not to call down against an opponent's aggressive action. And so the first section I mentioned, the first and last sections, I think were the most kind of instructive for me. So I'll take them one at a time. With barreling, I think a lot of us have looked at solver outputs over the last few years and realized that the solvers are firing that second barrel on the turn a lot more often than most humans used to do before a few years ago. And so kind of coming up with the plan for when and why to do that was instructive to me. And what was even more instructive, I would say, was in practice, just how often it worked. Like I was shocked at how often I would bet the flop small and get called and then bet big on the turn, they would fold. It happens over and over and over again in a lot of, against a lot of regular tournament players, typical tournament players. So I think I learned that there was a real practical help to my game from barreling more, in addition to all the theoretical fun reasons to work on it. I think that was instructive for me. And then the ICM stuff, I think, again, because we understand a lot more about high pressure ICM situations near or at the bubble, at the final table bubble, and early in the final table. Especially, we're learning exactly how to tighten up and also to attack people who are feeling the pressure. And I think I've pretty consciously been able to start adjusting my strategy way more than I ever used to. I mean, back in the day, I didn't really adjust at all for that stuff. If it was super close, I would adjust. But beyond that, I was mostly just playing to win all the time. And being able to make those adjustments has really bumped up a lot of otherwise what I think probably would have been bust outs, and non-cashing bust outs or finishes in ninth and 10th place, especially. I used to have back in the day, I had a lot of like ninths and firsts, which wasn't the end of the world, but I'm finding I'm still winning some tournaments now, and I have a lot more like fourths and fifths and thirds to go with them, and much fewer ninths and tenths. And I think that's because I've had a very conscious strategy adjustment to really do my best to avoid finishing in those most painful spots. And I think I try to explore that in the book as well.
On the barreling front, one thing that I like to emphasize, I mean, you were kind of talking about how many folds you get when you bet those turns, but the solvers are also betting. I know you know this, but just for the sake of people listening, the solvers are also betting, I think, more thinly for value on the turn, including for those big sizes than I was before I started looking at those sims, and than I think a lot of humans are. And one of the reasons why I emphasize this is because there are a lot of people who have a general sense that like they need to be more aggressive, and that's true, but they think that just translates into they need to do more bluffing, and that's not necessarily the case. And one thing that I do a lot of hand test or database reviews, and so I can identify something like, oh, your turn barreling frequency is low, but that by itself, that doesn't tell you what you need to do differently. Okay, like you need to bet the turn more often, but does that mean you need to bluff more often on the turn or make more thin value bets? And I'm curious if that's something that you've been conscious of or you've noticed in your own game in terms of identifying more opportunities to make thin value slash protection sorts of bets on the turn.
Yeah, that's a great point. And actually, the very first hand in the book, or I think it's the very first hand, is a barrel with a very weak top pair kind of situation. In a spot where a lot of people would just probably check back. I want to make sure that if you're going to barrel as bluffs, you have to make sure you're barreling thinner than you would think for value. And yeah, that is crucial, especially from a theoretical standpoint. Because if a good player notices that you're going to check back your top pairs, but then bet almost any time and you're missing, you're going to get destroyed. So, especially if you're going to play against people who are aware of your range and then your style and your play, you have to make sure you're getting those thin value bets in there. And yeah, even for the big sizes. And in fact, this came in my radar, I would say, for the first time, maybe not the first time, but back when you and I, Andrew, were both deep in that tournament. I think it was in 2019. There was a player at my table who made a big bet with two queens in this paired board, and he got called. I was like, oh, that was an interesting bet by that player. And the player I found out later was Andrew Brokus. And so I was like, okay, this is interesting. I'll have to look into it. And that's when I started looking into this theory of, kind of big, kind of thin value bets in some spots where you might not otherwise make them. And so, yeah, the focus on the section is the theme of the section is more about just increasing your barrel frequency overall, and but it does touch on you got to do it with some of your thin value hands as well.
I wasn't planning on getting into discussing specific hands this soon, but I actually played one just on Sunday that I'd be interested in running past you guys that is very much related to barreling, if you're up for it.
Of course.
Definitely.
So this is from a $200 tournament on ACR, getting somewhat close to the money. Probably something like 60% of the remaining players are going to cash. I am under the gun plus one at an eight-handed table. I have 31 blinds, which is actually the second largest stack at the table. Most of the table has like 20-ish blinds. The button does cover me by quite a lot. The button has 64 blinds, but they're not a player that I've seen before. And this is a fairly like I'm accustomed to recognizing like half or more of the players at my table in this tournament. So the fact that I have not seen this person before, I think, is meaningful in terms of they're probably not a regular. And I have King 10 offsuit. So this is fairly early position, under the gun plus one. Again, I have 31 blinds, cover most of the table, but not the button. Is this even a hand that you would open in the first place?
I can go first. I think that's borderline. I think if my opponents aren't three betting enough or are understanding how to respond to early raises well enough, then I'm probably going to open. If it's a table of tough pros, I'll probably fold. If it's a table of people who love to shove their 20 blind short stacks over an open, then I'll probably just fold. But if it's people who either flat too much or fold too much or both preflop, which describes most tournament fields, I would say I'll probably open. But I think in theory, at least, it's right in the borderline.
Yeah, I would expect this to be an open pretty much every time in theory. And honestly, Ace Nine offsuit is the one that I see as the borderline hand, and that's the one I rarely open because in the games I play, at least I get more flats than three bets, and I just hate playing a hand post flop. Just that, inability to make a straight is kind of a concern with that hand, but I would be surprised to see Ace 10 offsuit not being open.
We got King 10 though, right?
Yeah, King 10, that's it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said Ace 10. Sorry. Yeah, King 10.
I think King 10 and Ace 9 offsuit are close cousins,
Yeah, I think
though.
it's pretty similar. Yeah, I agree.
Exactly. Yeah. Everything I said about Ace 9, you can apply that to
Yeah.
King 10.
Okay, so I did open, obviously. This is not just a question where I folded preflop.
Yeah, usually here for you guys. I folded King 10 offsuit into this one.
And it does fold around only the big blind calls. The big blind has 20 blinds remaining after they call. So we've got five and a half in the pot, 20 in the big blind stack, 30 in my stack. And again, we are somewhat close to the bubble. About 60% of the remaining field is going to cash. So there is, I think, a non-trivial amount of ICM consideration here, more so for the big blind than for me, but for both of us. I have specifically the king of clubs and the 10 of hearts, and the flop is ace of clubs, jack of clubs, five of spades. The big blind checks to me, and I mean, my general thinking is like, I'm probably just going to bet my entire range here. I don't, that might not be exactly what a solver strategy would be, but I think it's, especially when you're dealing with humans who don't check raise enough, and once there's the ISM pressure on the big blind, I think it's probably like a good default to just like bet small with your entire range. And then this exact hand strikes me as one that's probably going to be pretty good for barreling, because in addition to having the straight draw, like the king of clubs blocker is going to be useful, especially if a third club falls.
I don't have much to add to that, Andrew. I agree with all of that. I would bet my whole range small here. I was going to ask you if you were one of the players who considers using two different sizes here, as I'm sure the solver probably would. But I like to default to a simple strategy. I can use my whole range here, and I know that I'm really not giving anything away in terms of equity by just simplifying to I'm betting small with my whole range here. And then, yeah, looking ahead to the next street, potentially if we get called, yes, we have a hand that is going to be a very good candidate to barrel, whether or not we hit, unless we hit like a exactly one pair or something.
I don't do much splitting in terms of like using different sizes on the same flop. I tend to more just say in this spot, the spot being positions and stack sizes and ICM and board texture, which size, if I'm going to simplify it using one size with my entire betting range, not necessarily my entire range, but like I'm going to make a better check decision. And with that betting range, it's almost always, unless I'm really doing something exploitative, it's almost always going to be just, choosing a size that seems appropriate for the situation and then making a binary decision to either bet that size or check.
That's what I do too, and that's what I advise in the book, but I was curious what your thoughts were.
Yeah, my experimentation with, and I wrote a GTO Wizard article about this. You can look at even a really complicated spot, or like a cash game spot, you're 100 big blinds deep, and it wants to use, if you give it five different bet sizes, it'll use five different bet sizes. But if you then say, take away, it's allowed to choose one, and you let it choose. If you dictate the bet size, that'll mess up the EV more. But if you say, solver, you can choose whatever bet size you want, but you only get one bet size, it really does not affect the EV hardly at all. And the way that I think about this is, sizing becomes more important as you get closer to the river because there's not room to make up the difference anymore. The net amount of money that you put into the pot matters a lot. How that money goes in is much more secondary. So whether you bet small on three streets or you check twice and you bet big on the final street, I mean, it makes a little bit of difference, but it doesn't make that much of a difference. The net amount of money that you put into the pot is a lot more important. And so if you bet small on the flop, you can make up the difference by betting big later. If you don't bet the flop at all, you can make up the difference by betting later. If you do bet the flop, you can make up the difference by checking later. It's, you're not really, screwing yourself over that much by just simplifying to one size.
Yeah, again, I couldn't agree more. I make a similar point in the book that if I need to try to get more value out of some of my stronger hands here, then I'll deal with that on the later streets. I'm not going to do it by starting with a bigger bet now. But I really like the way you just kind of put it, though, which is the sizing matters more on the later streets. Like on the flop, you can almost do whatever you want as long as it makes sense. The only thing I would add is if you do try to use different sizes on a flop, and I mentioned this in the book as well, it's almost inevitable that you're going to leak information that you don't want to be leaking, because it's very hard to actually balance both of those sizes. And humans will just, they won't bluff enough if they're making some big bet that they don't normally make. And they won't have enough strong hands if they're betting super small in a spot where they often bet a different size. So it's just easier and I think better on many levels to just pick a size for any board and go with it on the flop.
Yeah, I think this is like a meta skill in poker that's becoming more and more important, which is knowing how to work with a tool like GTO Wizard. And of the various things that Wizard does that are maybe not exactly what you're doing, recognizing which ones are actually worth worrying about and then which ones are not, rather than just trying to say, like, my goal is just to make my play look exactly what Wizard would do in every single situation. Like, I think unless you're playing super high rollers or something, even then, maybe that's not necessarily the goal. But like, I think certainly for most of us mere mortals, the goal is not replicate exactly what Wizard is doing. And so trying to identify what are the spots where it actually matters that I'm deviating from what Wizard is doing, and what are the cases where I actually can just like simplify and make my life easier. And it's not that big of a deal in terms of like using your studying time and just your like brain capacity effectively. I think making those distinctions is I something that I feel is adding a lot of value to my study game, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
I agree with that as well. I did have a different question that might derail the hand, so I'll kind of save it for later. It's kind of related to it's related to this, but I'll make a note to come back to it.
So I bet 20% pot on the flop, 1.1 into a pot of 5.5. The big blind calls, and we get the four of diamonds on the turn. So the board is now ace of clubs, jack of clubs, five of spades, four of diamonds. I am holding king 10 with the king of clubs. 7.7 blinds in the pot, 19 in my opponent's stack, 28 in my stack, and the big blind checks to me again. I think we had sort of tentatively agreed that we like this hand as a candidate for barreling. Do we want to barrel here? And if so, how are you thinking about sizing?
I do like the barrel here, as we were talking about before. This is a really good card for barreling because it doesn't really help almost any of the hands in big blinds range that would appeal. None of the draws, straight draws, or flush draws are improved. Not a lot of.
Technically, 2-3 is improving to the straight.
Oh, excuse me, deuce three. Yes.
Now, with there being ICM on the big blind, like, I mean, I don't would not expect to see 2-3 offsuit in their range. I suppose 2-3 suited probably is in there.
There are four combos of deuce three suited. I will give you that. Yes. But still, a relative blank on the turn is good news for a barreling candidate. As for sizing, I mean, you could tell me what you think of this, but having looked at a lot of solver outputs here in these spots where, and it comes up all the time in tournament poker because we're often playing these like 22 to 30 big blind stack size situations, you'll often get to the turn with an SPR of like around two, two and a half, something like that. And so I often like to size around roughly a quarter of the effective stacks here. So I'm thinking about maybe four and a half to five big blinds barreling the spot. The pot has seven in it, you said roughly. So, and the opponent has about 19 blinds, I think we said. So yeah, I'm looking at about that sizing, and that sets up a nice potential river shove if I want to do it. I don't think it's perfectly geometric to do it that way, but that's the sizing I kind of like to land on. So if we do bet five and get called, there's going to be like 17 and change in the pot, and an opponent will have maybe 14 or something left. I feel like that's a nice setup for a river shove. So that's kind of what I'm thinking. What are you thinking?
I can say I did bet five, which is
There you go.
exactly what you said. I think my reasoning would have been pretty similar to yours. Carlos, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would just go 2E here. The geometric size that Matt was talking about. I don't know exactly what it is because I play online and the computer does it for me. But whatever size that is, that's what I would choose.
Wait, you can, is you have an option to actually bet 2E on On Ignition?
With the secondary piece of software, Ignition can't do it itself. It's one of these things. It's called Jirogen. It's similar to you'll be familiar with Table Ninja from back in the day. It's something like that.
Oh, wow. I've never even heard of this.
Yeah, but that's really cool. You can just press the 2E button. So whatever size that is, that's what I would use.
Oh, yeah. I mean, 'cause that is what I was, but I was doing that in my head. I didn't know that was a thing that would do that for me.
Right, same here.
Yeah, and there's also like a formula you can use to do it. I saw it once, but I didn't bother to remember it. But there is kind of a 2E formula.
Okay, I'm gonna have to look into this. But yes, yeah, so I bet five, and I do find it useful, and I encourage people to try to have a plan for barreling the river, because if you don't, I think too often you kind of go based on emotion of something that you feel desperate and you bluff too much, or you look for excuses to bluff, or conversely, you get scared and you talk yourself out of bluffing. So I like to have a plan for at least like, common rivers, which I think in this case is just like, are we shoving club rivers? Are we shoving non-club rivers? I think those are the two main things I'd be thinking about here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think going back to your initial question of what are some things I learned this year, I think that's a huge point because you're not often finding yourselves in a huge pot on the river because tournament stacks aren't usually deep enough. But when the occasions do arise, you really want to be ready for it because it's so tempting at that point. You had such a good plan for flop and turn, and now all of a sudden you're on the river with six high. And if you just always shove, you're going to be bluffing too often. But if you never shove, you're going to be bluffing enough. And so taking a step back and instead of thinking, okay, the only way I can win is to bluff, or oh my God, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Having a plan in advance is super helpful. And also just learning how to think through the river spot, which is again another section of my book, I think is a great skill to work on as well. Even if it doesn't come up nearly as often as other tournament skills, like we're talking about now, like barreling or opening ranges or three bet ranges with 20 or 30 blinds. Those are the kind of core tournament skills. But these river skills, even though they only come up maybe, maybe not even once a tournament, they're so crucial when they do come up that you'll want to get them right.
So my thinking here was I'm gonna barrel club rivers and give up on non-club rivers. I mean, obviously the ones that if I actually get a queen, that'll be a different story where I made a straight. I would not be looking to bet a king or a 10 either. I don't know that rivering a 10 actually gives me that much showdown value once he calls a second turn barrel, but yeah, I guess I was just thinking I'm not gonna be so. I mean, the 10 of clubs would be the one case where I would not be shoving a club river. But other than that, I think my general plan was shove clubs, but give up if it's a blank.
If you feel like the hitting a 10 doesn't give you much showdown value, why not continue barreling on the 10 of clubs?
Yeah, it could be. I don't think I did consider that in game. I was just sort of thinking through it in real time now. I guess I'm considering maybe he could still have stuff like 4-3, which is like a pair and a gut shot kind of hand where the showdown value, it may not be a lot, but I'm not expecting the EV of bluffing to be that high either. So I think the difference between having like 15% of the pot as showdown value, like it's not a big number, but I think that's enough to make it better than bluffing.
That makes sense.
But I mean, I'm not entirely sure that's true.
But getting back to the main point of barreling on club rivers, that I think is crucial. I think that's people know they're supposed to barrel the club barrel in the turn when they have the king of clubs, but they maybe not don't always take the logical next step and say, well, why is that? Well, part of the reason is that you can bluff again on the river when a club comes. And if you're not going to do that, then it almost doesn't matter that you have, I mean, it matters a little, but a big part of the reason why you get to barrel the turn when you have the king of clubs is because you have these rivers that can come off that let you barrel again. As for the 10 of clubs hitting on the end, which if it did, yeah, that's kind of a tricky spot. I hear what you're saying, Andrew and Carlos. I think you're both making pretty good points because I think a good test question for these bluff spots in the river, at least one of the test questions, is what are the hands I'm trying to get to fold? If the answer is I'm trying to get a weak ace to fold, which it probably wouldn't be in theory, but in practice, if you're trying to get the big blind to fold as ace four or ace five, the 10 of clubs is a pretty good card for that. If you're trying to get folds from more stubborn hands that have called to this point, so like Andrew was saying, if your goal in bluffing is to get the wheel draws that made a pair on the turn or something, to now fold the river, then of course it doesn't make any sense to do it with the tent. So I kind of see both sides of this, and I think this is where the more information you have about the kind of tournament player you're dealing with, the better decision you can make. Because I do think there are some players who would fold a lot stronger hands than you might think here when the 10 of clubs hits on the river. So I wouldn't automatically check back that card, but I mean that's definitely a tricky spot for all the reasons you're saying.
Yeah, and this is a level of planning that I don't require of myself in game, where it's like, okay, I can think about club rivers, I can think about non-club rivers, maybe even the back of my head, I have the, if I pair my hand, that's going to change the way I think about it, kind of like big category. And then sometimes there's one specific card that's sort of weird and you didn't have a plan for it. That's okay. Like, I don't think you have to plan for literally, I mean, I'm not scolding you guys, just telling the listeners, you don't have to plan for literally every possible river card, but you do want to have a general sense of like, big categories of things like if the flush completes, do I shove? If it's a blank, do I shove? That kind of thing.
Yep.
Okay, so I bet 5 into 7.7, and I think we're on the same page about what the plan is, except that the big blind calls really quickly. Like, it felt bad, like how quickly they called the turn bet. And the river did indeed bring a third club, the nine of clubs. So we're now looking at a board of ace of clubs, jack of clubs, five of spades, four of diamonds, nine of clubs. 17.7 blinds in the pot, 14 in the big blind stack, 23 in my stack. So we had our plan. The plan was to shove on club rivers. And I'm curious if, what it would take for you to like pull the ripcord and decide to parachute away from this plan rather than execute on it. Given that, or my expectation anyway, is that this should be a plus EV bluff. This should not be a like, I'm indifferent to bluffing with this hand. The value of bluffing is extremely sensitive to my opponent's response. I think holding a really valuable blocker like the King of Clubs should make this a pure bluff at equilibrium. But even pure bluffs at equilibrium could lose their value if you had a read that the big blind is going to call too much. And I mean, obviously, I was the one at the table, so I'm asking you to, tell me in this exact situation. But I guess, just generally speaking, like, what would it take for you to step away from your plan if you picking up on, a live read or something that was kind of causing you to have legitimate doubt as to like the wisdom of continuing to try to bluff?
Oh man, I mean, this is tricky to me specifically because the quick call on the turn, I mean, the first hand I'm going to put them on when they call super fast is the club draw. And so now am I just bluffing into someone who's trapped me by rivering a club? On the other hand, if it was a super, it could also be a super quick call with the hands you were talking about before, which was to remind me, the flop was ace jack five, and the turn was a four, right? So it could be something like four three suited, four deuce suited, which also might call very quickly on the turn with a pair and a gut shot. And it could also be king queen, which might have decided to call super fast with gut shot. That's a little less likely. You think king queen, if they're going to call the turn, would at least think about it a little longer rather than just immediately get the chips into, but it kind of depends how fishy they are. I might consider doing something weird here and making a small bet. That's probably not justified theoretically, but in practice, if we think, okay, well, there's a decent chance it's just a flush and it doesn't matter what size I bet, I'm just going to lose. But there's a bunch of other pretty weak draws that actually beat my hand that are not going to call a bet of any size. So it would be a purely exploitive play, but I might consider actually betting some non-all-in amount here just to make sure I fold out the small pairs, but that I can safely bet fold if I get shoved on. Again, I'm not suggesting that this is a theoretical solution, but in practice, it might be something I would consider.
I guess my understanding would be the hands that we think of as a small pair plus draw that called on the turn, those draws would be the flush draw that came in, right?
I guess the other possibility would be like a 4-3 or a 5-3 that was a third or fourth pair with a gut shot.
Like a pair in the
Yeah.
gutter. I think Matt's plan is good to target those sort of hands. Question is, do those hands kind of like snap call with a weak pair and a gutter on a board where a flush draw is available, facing a big bet? NICM.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the one thing that's possible, I did take a little time because I didn't have a button that calculated 2E for me. So I did have to think a little bit about my sizing. It's possible that this person, you know, while I was thinking about my sizing, they were thinking about what I was gonna what they were gonna do if I bet, such that, you know, they had just kind of already made up their mind, and it didn't mean they didn't have time to think. It meant that they had already had the time that they needed to think, and they knew what they were gonna do. Or even, I mean, I remember this from Zach Elwood's books. I think there's a little bit more of a live poker thing, but I mean, quick calls are not necessarily strong. I mean, sometimes it's even a thing that people are doing because they're trying to deter you from bluffing. So like my feeling in game was like, oh, that felt strong, but you know, I don't that's not necessarily like a word of God. This is what a quick bet means.
Oh yeah, I would actually. My first thought was a draw when you said super quick call, and the other option to me is not really a super strong hand, but it could be a hand that's pretty good, but does want to deter you from bluffing again. So some kind of, you know, mediocre made hand, like some weakish ace. And so this is why maybe I don't love my small bet idea in the end, because if this person didn't love their hand enough on the turn and they're going to call quick, then you want to make sure you they fold out on the river, and they might call another small bet with an ace, but they might very well fold to a shove. Yeah, the quick call, I mean, if you had a super strong hand on this turn, wouldn't you at least consider raising? I mean, there's all these straight draws and flush draws on the board. If you were really strong here, you wouldn't just like snap call. You would at least think about it. You might end up calling, but you're at least going to. Now, I know you hear what you're saying, that the person had some time to think about what they wanted to do, but still.
Yeah, I guess by super strong, I don't mean like two pair. I just mean like a top pair where they've just like, okay, I'm never folding this. So,
Or draw or a pair and a draw.
yeah, that's
Like
true.
we mentioned, and I guess to me, maybe not all pairs and draws are created equal in this spot, because I don't necessarily expect the snap call from the gutter with a small pair when the flush draw is available. But I do expect it from like a pair plus a flush draw, which is a concern here. To me, it's an indication of mediumness more so than strength.
Yeah, this is a cool hand, Andrew, because it really is exploitive versus optimal ideas. I mean, optimally, as we said from the beginning, you definitely have a strong case for shoving this hand. That's the whole reason we barreled the turn. But because we had this timing tell from the turn, and we can put our opponent really on certain only certain types of hands on this river. I mean, at this point, they don't have some random jack. I think we all pretty much agree, and that's the main hand you're probably trying to get to fold with a river barrel. And so if we take that out of their range and we believe that read, then I think our case for bluffing goes way down. So I don't know. I think exploitively you could really justify checking back or betting small or something here. I don't know if I would actually do it in game. I'd be so annoyed at myself for not bluffing with this king of clubs, with that timing tell though, I would really think about it for a while. I might end up just shutting down.
I do think if we put some top pairs in his range due to that time and tell, we might be able to get those to fold once the flush draw comes in. Because you got to remember, we open from early position and we bet three streets. So even if they have top pair with a weak kicker, there's more than just the flush draw for them to be afraid of, given our line.
Absolutely.
I appreciate you saying that because I was starting to worry this is just going to feel like, I mean, it's obviously not actually a bad beat, but you know, like a trivial hand that I was just felt bad about. So I did end up jamming the river, and he called quickly with ace nine, which was a river two pair, although I don't really imagine that the nine on the river changed anything for him. Like
Oh,
I imagine this.
I think it very well might have changed something.
Well, now I really appreciate you saying
If he has a
that.
mediocre a random ace and the river is a club that doesn't help him, I don't know. I think you might win this hand. I hate losing hands like this when the river makes an opponent a random two pair and makes their call automatic. God, it drives me nuts. But yeah, I mean, this was the other option with the quick call on the turn, was some kind of top pair that's never going to fold but never going to raise, and they're just done with that. That's what they're going to do. And to me, that part of the range was the biggest reason for jamming the river, because I think against a human, a solver is not going to fold those hands, I don't think, but a human might. He obviously doesn't have the nine of clubs in his hand because that hit on the river, so it's not like he had some club blocker to work with. So I mean, you just got unlucky there, I think. Yeah, I mean, I think your river decision was really interesting against humans. And I think if it's Personally, if I'm not super convinced by my read, I probably, like I said, I would have in practice, I probably would have ended up bluffing anyway, but if I really believed in my read, timing tell read in the turn, I might have shut down. And you're right, he might have called with ace nine anyway if the river had been the seven of clubs, let's say. I mean, who knows? But once he can beat ace king, he's not going anywhere.
Yeah, I think there's no, I mean, I even took a little bit of time on the river to try to imply that I was, considering a thin value shove or something, to suggest that it wasn't just a super polar, like either I have a flush or I'm bluffing. So yeah, I was trying to imply that I might have ace king, which does make it an easy call for him with ace nine.
Yep.
Yeah, there's something else with this hand that we haven't really considered yet, and it's probably more of a concern against higher level players. But when you open from that position with that stack size and you get this board, you actually don't have very many flushes with the ace, jack, and the nine out there. It's like king, queen, king, 10. And a few like queen X combos, and that's about it. Like maybe 9-8 suited. Actually,
Queen
that's blocked by the
10
board
suited.
too. Right. So you only have like what, four or five, if that, combos of flushes. So a higher level player can recognize that and maybe bluff catch you a little bit lighter because you have a decent number of combos that contain just the king of d diamonds. I mean, sorry, the king of clubs. Especially if you're willing to turn something like a king jack into a bluff. But yeah, I don't think you have to worry about that against the average opponent. But just as a general rule of thumb, I'm always like when I'm in the big blind in this case, I'm always looking to bluff early position players when the flush comes in because the big blind is going to have way more flushes than you on this run out. So like, imagine the same hand happens, and you have something like ace king, and this person snap calls turn and then lead jams into you on this river. That's kind of a nasty spot to be in.
And I think Carlos, that point circles back to a point that Andrew made early on, which is that you do have to make sure you're value betting thin enough. Because you're absolutely right. If the flush card is going to slow you down to the point where you're only value betting like flushes on this river, then the big blind can snap you off all day with pretty much anything. So you've got to be willing to make this shove with your ace kings, your ace queens, and of course any hand better than that. And I think the value of having the king of clubs blocker is not so much that, oh, we can represent the flush now. I mean, it's sort of that, but it's also, it just takes away so many combinations of strong hands from our opponent that we can now target their weaker hands a bit more aggressively. But you're absolutely right that we've got to make sure we are value betting thin enough here, at least in theory. It's a good player, like you're saying,
Yeah, in theory.
who'll be able to give us credit for ace queen in this spot. Yeah, especially if you have the king or queen of clubs in your hand, then value betting the ace king or ace queen here should be something that you're doing.
Yeah, I'm glad you said in theory to add that point because in practice, a lot of times we were just saying that if we jam, we might be able to get this guy off of a bluff catcher, which we, when we have something like ace king, if we know that, we might want to size down. We, still value bet it, but size down to make sure he calls. And now our small bet size is unbalanced in terms of being too strong, and the jam is unbalanced in terms of being too weak,
And
which is perfectly fine against 99% of players. But like you said, in theory, against a really good player, we probably need to make sure we jam ace king on the river because of the what I said about them having more flushes than us, that is what incentivizes them to make the bluff catch to pay off our ace king. So we're not worried about a good player folding, a decent bluff catcher versus ace king like we would against a weaker player.
And that sizing tell you mentioned, Carlos, is happens for all the time with typical tournament players. When they make that kind of small in position bet in a spot like this, it's almost always a thin value bet. And what I struggle with as a person playing against them is not so much whether to pay that off, because I usually don't, because they just always have a decent to okay-ish one pair hand. So if I have a similar type of hand myself, of course I call, but anything worse than that, like I just don't even bother calling. What I struggle with is whether I should then check raise bluff against those bets, because I know they don't have very much and I know I can represent a strong hand. The problem is they end up calling me a lot of the time anyway. So I talk about this in the book. Like I never, sometimes I do it and it works. Sometimes I do it and it doesn't work and I get mad. Sometimes I don't do it. And every once in a while I do call, even though I shouldn't in this spot. And I get so annoyed at myself. Why didn't I try the check raise bluff? Because it'll be like two kings or something here. And so like, I'm like, well, there's no way two kings was going to call the check raise shove, right? But that's a spot that I struggle with exploitively. And lately what I do is I just fold because they call too often when I check raise and I know that they have me beat. And so I don't bother putting more money in. But every once in a while, if there's enough ICM pressure and if it's someone who really is more capable than most of folding, I might try it. And it does work some. I mean, it doesn't have to work that often to be good, right? And it does definitely work sometimes, but it's frustrating to me because I know it's not a good theoretical play. I basically know what they have, and then I struggle to figure out what to do about it. So, but you're right, it's totally imbalanced from a lot of players here when they go small. And so that's part of the reason I kind of like the small bet bluff idea almost, because people think you actually have ace king when you do that. And so some players will just fold there. So it's an interesting spot. It's a spot where you can really justify a lot of different decisions. And I think the more you know about how your opponent plays and how your opponent feels the pressure of these spots and how invested they are in trying to cash or trying to build this, any other information you can bring in at this point is helpful. But in theory, definitely shove. And if you don't have a strong argument against it, I think that's what you should do.
Okay, Matt, I have a suggestion for you.
Yes.
The next time you're in this spot as the big blind, you're facing one of these players where you're unsure what to do when you check river and they make the small bet, don't even give them the option. Just leave river.
And I mean, you could do that as well, of course, especially if it's a scary river card.
On this river card, on the when the flush comes in a spot where the board blocks the vast majority of the flushes they can have. But, you know, as the big blind defender, you can have like pretty much every suited card. So you just have like a really, really big flush advantage in this spot. And I think that might give you license to lead river here.
And you, by lead river, you mean just lead out and jam yourself? Or do you mean?
Right. When they bet turn, you check call. And when that flush comes in on the river, you can jam, and I think with these stack sizes, you probably would have to. But if stacks are deeper, it doesn't necessarily have to be a jam. But just put yourself in the opener's shoes with a decent ace here, and that happens, especially if you're up against an unsteady player who you probably doesn't think bluffs enough. Like, to me, that's kind of a nasty spot to be in, even with something like ace-king. Like, without a flush blocker, I might fold to that.
The issue is you have to know in advance that you're trying to get a fold. So I'm talking about finding myself in a spot like this where I myself have something like queen jack or king jack or even like ace six or ace seven. And so I've played the line pretty naturally to this point to check and call twice. And on the river, it really looks like I have a check again. And I'm hoping they check back with their big pocket pair or their middle pair or whatever, and I just win. Doesn't seem to make much sense to shove. But then when they make the small bet, I'm like, okay, I know now this is an ace and I can't win unless I shove. But they're probably not going to fold, or are they going to fold? I mean, it really looks like, like you say, it looks like you have a flush. So I don't know. That is where I struggle. And I will say the times when this has worked have been when it's the most pressure. So I did this actually in the main event a million years ago. I played this huge pot with one of the chip leaders of the whole tournament, like super deep in the tournament. He had raised an early position and I defended my big blind. And the flop was, I believe, jack seven deuce or something. And I had king jack and I check called. The turn was like a four or something irrelevant. I check called again and the river was an ace. And I checked, and now the guy put out a super small bet. And I check raise, turning my king jack into a bluff. And he actually took a long time and then folded jack seven for the flop top two. He had jack seven suited. folded them face up to my river check raise. That's an example, I think, of a hand that normally it's right about what you think they're going to have. They're making a really small value bet with some bad two pair, but they're going to end up calling when you check raise, but not in the main event. In the main event, who is bluffing there? Like, that's whoever doesn't have it there. And he even said out loud, please tell me you have King Jack. You call with King Jack there sometimes. And I almost said, well, I didn't call it at that time because that's I actually had it. But it worked because it was such a high pressure, like high stakes environment where it was a person who was a good enough player to understand that it's a crazy spot to bluff. And he knew that he should have much stronger hands there, or for whatever reason, he gave me credit for having the aces up that I was representing. But in typical online tournaments, they just click call with those hands. And so that's where I struggle is when I have something like that, some medium strength hand myself that doesn't really want to shove and lose the maximum against almost every better hand. But then I get new information after I check that, oh, my hand is no good. What am I supposed to do about it? And nowadays I just fold usually. But every once in a while, I might still try the check raise. I'm still going back and forth about like when's a good time to try and when not.
A little off topic, but I just want to emphasize what a bad idea it is for him to show that fold. Not just because of the sort of like future implication of like, oh, now people are going to be coming after him with bluffs or something, but just to give you that confidence boost of like letting you know that you outplayed him. I think it's even worse in cases where they fold and then you show them that you had a good hand. Because otherwise that fold, and I know this as a poker coach, like it just eats at people when they make a fold, even if it's like sort of a good fold that they should be proud of, the possibility they might have gotten bluffed just eats at them. And when you alleviate that, you know, just sort of show them like, oh, don't worry, I had it. It just relieves that pressure from them. And so I think there's something similar happening here where he's like that confidence boost when like deep in the main event of just like, yeah, I was willing to take a big risk and it paid out. Like so many people are not willing to take those big risks. And even when you're a good player, it's still hard to like screw up the courage to actually do it. And so giving you that confidence boost of like, look, you did it and it paid off. Yeah. It's just such a dangerous thing to like to offer you.
He lost twice in the hand.
Yes. Sorry, Carlos, you had said a million years ago that there was something that you wanted to come back to in this hand.
Yeah. So we were talking about whether or not to split your range into two different sizes on the c-bet in this hand. And it reminded me, and this is not exactly the same thing, but it reminded me of something that I heard from a really good player who was coaching another really good player when I was doing some studying. And I'm going to like throw the caveat out there that I may have just heard this wrong, but the idea that I think he was saying is that same thing can apply in spots where you're facing a bet and you're deciding between mixing with a particular combo between calls or raises. And the solver does this a lot. Like, for example, let's say guy opens, you defend the big blind, flop comes whatever, you check, he bets, and now you have a hand where the solver will sometimes call and sometimes raise. I think what this guy suggested is that his entire continuing range versus his bet, he's just going to check raise everything that he wants to continue with, or he's going to call everything that he wants to continue with. He's not going to try to split because as a human, that's too hard to do. And I think his idea was, on boards where he should have a pretty good, I won't say range advantage, I'll say like nut advantage. Let's say some board like 8-7-5 or something, where not so low and connected where you would lead, or even if you're the type of player who chooses not to lead on these sort of boards, say like a 6-5-4 is like the classic board where the big blind defends and they get leads. But a lot of humans say that they want to simplify their strategy so they don't lead on those boards. It's like if you have a hand that you may want to just check and call with, you're better off just check raising your entire range on those sort of boards, as opposed to trying to split the way the solver does. If you have a board where you almost always check calls, like for example, might not be able to think of a great example for this one. Let's say something like ace-9-4. And you defend pocket fours. Like you might want to check raise that hand facing a c-bet, but is one of the few hands in your range that you want to check raise. So I think what the guy advocated for is just check calling everything on like the ace 9-4 and check raising everything on like the 6-5-4, as opposed to trying to split like the solver was would. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I would say I think that works a lot better on some boards than others. So the examples you gave were pretty good ones where I think it would work. Like you're not gonna have a lot of check raises on ace 9-4, and you have a ton of check raises on 6-5-4. So just kind of simplifying in those spots, I think makes sense. But on a board, let's say like Jack 8-3 with two hearts or something, there's lots of like semi-bluff check raising you'll want to do, but you probably don't want to be check raising with your random like 8-5 and Jack Deuce or whatever, if you're the big blind. And so I think doing it for every single board might be getting carried away. And I think you can find ways to balance your check raising and check calling ranges on some of those boards. But on a board like 9-9-4, for example, sure, you can just play check raise or check fold because you're going to want to check raise a ton of hands anyway in that spot. And you're not going to want to have, there's not a lot of natural calls. Basically, the solver in that spot will check raise nines, fours, and a bunch of semi bluffs, and we'll check call with some ace highs and a few other things. You can just kind of skip the check call of the ace highs if you want it, and check raise, just play pure check raise or check fold. But on other boards, it won't work as well because you'll want to have hands like on King 10 six or something. You'll want to check raise for value with some of your top pairs, but you're probably not going to want to check raise too often with like your medium strength hands. So I think, it's a good idea to simplify whenever you can, but there comes a point where you'll do better by taking advantage of both options to some degree.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
That was almost word for word. Well, the first sentence anyway, like exactly what I was gonna say. I'm just like it. I think there's boards where you're supposed to have a like 20 plus percent check raise frequency anyway, and boards where you're supposed to have a like 6 or 7% check raise frequency, and both of those are reasonable to simplify. But yeah, I think there are some like the ones where you're supposed to have a 13-ish percent check raising frequency. I think those check raises are important enough that you don't want to just like forfeit all of them. But I also think you're not really, you don't have enough strength to just check raise everything. That would be my I mean, it sounds like the person who said this is a better player than I am. So I don't want to gainsay them too much, but that's my reaction to that.
And to be fair, this was a pair board, kind of like the one, the 9-9-4 that
Yeah.
that Matt mentioned. Honestly, like there's a decent chance it could have been that exact board. But
Peroz Jaca recently mentioned a board like this where he played an interesting hand deep in a big tournament, and he was saying that like the solver strategy for this paired board is pretty much to just play pure check raise or check fold. I actually couldn't quite replicate what he was saying in the outputs I saw. There was at least some check calling, like I said, with those ace high kind of hands especially. But his main point though was certainly valid, which is it's a board with a ton of check raising. Yeah, and any low paired board is like a big blind check raising high frequency spot to check raise for the big blind. So those are good candidates for sure.
by the way, this was a hand that I learned that I saw on Faraz's site, and it was a guy coaching Faraz. And so I don't remember the coach's name, but I think I wanted to be careful about mentioning who it was in case. But I did give the cat in case I, misheard him. But I did get the caveat that I may have misheard him. But you might have saw the exact same thing I saw.
Yeah, I didn't see Faraz hearing from his coach, but Faraz posted this amazing, crazy, not crazy, I mean, 'cause I like the play, but it was this blockbuster turn re-raise all in bluff on the bubble of a big tournament. And it started out with him check raising on this paired board. And so you guys can find that. I don't want to spend our time going over Faraz's hand, but that is where I was what I was thinking of.
Right. So the only thing about the idea that was like revolutionary to me was the hands that really don't like, if you have a board like the small pair board we mentioned, there's a lot of hands that you would continue with that really don't feel comfortable to me as check raises, like ace high, for example. Like on a 9-9-4, you're supposed to be calling C bets with your ace highs, but it feels a little bit uncomfortable to check raise all my ace highs there. But I think that's what the coach was suggesting. And then also on the ace 9-4 board I mentioned, if stacks are deep enough, it feels uncomfortable for me to just call with pocket fours there. I want to blow this pot. the board is good for this guy's range. Like, I want to get value. So it sucks so bad to check call there and then turn goes check, check. But if the idea is to simplify your strategy to, like, simplify it in a way where you're not splitting your ranges too much, I guess that's the price you have to pay. But it's something that I heard, and I'm kind of mulling it over in my brain and experimenting with it to see if I like it. Like, I like the general idea, but I can think of a few exceptions like that where it's kind of like it's difficult for me to, stick to that strategy.
I mean, I think if you understand your range and how you're splitting it up, you can kind of get away with doing both things. So as long as you understand when you check call the flop with ace high that most of your check call range is going to be various ace highs, then you understand that you can't just fold the turn with ace high if they barrel again, because this your whole range at this point is a bunch of ace high hands. And so some of them, the ones that for whatever reason, whether it's blocker reason or whatever the flush suits are or the strength of your ace high, you have to find some reason to call again with some of them, or else you are going to get exploited. And with the fours, I think you can check raise them as long as you also have some occasional bluffs there, which could be a bit harder to find an ace nine four. There's no natural bluffs really. So you got to make sure you're turning your, jack 10 suited or your, occasional wheel draws or whatever into check raises. And if you're doing that sometimes, at least enough, then you can get away with it. It's just all about thinking about your range overall. And so if you can kind of play, understand how you're playing your range, then I think you can split up your strategy. But I mean, the other alternative is, of course, just keep it as simple as possible. Now you have to worry about what hands have I check call with. Well, if you've check call with your entire continuing range, then it's easy to remember. But if you don't have certain things in your check raising range or in your check call range, you just have to be aware of that going forward and kind of adjust accordingly.
See, Matt, that's my problem. Everything that you just mentioned, I tend to do. I will check raises Jack 10. I probably don't call twice with the ace enough on the pair board. But in my mind, I'm thinking, like, I can do these mixes and, I can, like, somewhat balance my range later. But then when I hear Faraz's coach is saying he's not good enough to do it, now I'm thinking, like, maybe I'm
Yeah,
not doing that good of a job with this.
it's funny.
this reminds me, Carlos, of the video that you showed me years ago that I still think of as the best training video that I've ever seen. I mean, this is before I understood a lot of game theory concepts that I do now, but it was from Phil Galfond, and he was talking about c-betting out of position, or really responding to c-bets from out of position pre-flop raisers on boards where they really are not supposed to have a lot of c-bets. And he was doing some like node locking, and he builds these profiles of different types of players and how you can exploit them. And one of them was just sort of a very straightforward player who's just like c-betting their entire range and how to exploit them. And then he identify, I forget the term that he used for it, but he essentially like a player who thinks that they're balanced, and he's sort of like, okay, so they bet their top pairs, they bet their draws, and like, okay, I'm balanced here, but like, and like essentially just like was describing me, it's just like eviscerating. It's like, you think you're doing this balanced thing, but like actually it's not even close to what you should be doing, and like here's how you get eviscerated by a player who knows what they're doing.
And you know it when you dig into these solver outputs. When you look in these solver outputs and you see, like, okay, I know what my value raises are, my value bets or whatever. And I look through the solver's bluffs and I see, okay, I'm bluffing with this, I'm bluffing that. I got some bluffs. And then you look through and you see, oh, there's probably like two-thirds of the bluffs I'm supposed to have that I don't have. And it's like it's eye-opening, and at that point you can decide to get better and actually learn all that stuff and try to play more like the solver, or you can try to simplify. And it sounds like this guy is saying that your best bet is try to simplify, because no matter how hard you try, you're gonna have some bluffs, so you're not gonna be wildly unbalanced, but there's enough bluffs that you don't have that's making you just unbalanced enough to make you exploitable, and you might not even recognize how, like, it feels like that leak isn't that big, and then there might just be a better player just constantly exploiting you in that spot. And that was scary to me. Like, anytime like that's just like my general rule of thumb. Anytime I'm doing something and I hear a much better player than me saying that they're not good enough to do the thing that I think I'm doing well, that's scary.
Yeah,
For sure. I'll have to look up that Galfond video. That sounds fantastic.
For a while, it was one of the, it was like a free one. There were a couple that you could get for free. You didn't even have to sign. I mean, I think you had to like give them your email address, but you didn't have to sign up for anything. And I mean, I think I was not the only one to think it was one of the best training videos I'd ever seen. You know, it was, they knew that, and that was why they were using it to promote the site. So where is the book available, Matt?
On Amazon, where all my recent poker books, like The Poker Brain, The Game Plan, last year's book, 23, Nolan Holden Tournament Hands from 2023, all four of those books, and the new one, 24 Hands from 2024, you can find them all on Amazon. They print on demand, so they're always available, and I appreciate anybody checking them out.
Now, I'm not calling you out here because my books are also published on Amazon, but I mean, do you have qualms about that? Like, you know, they've been bad with like labor stuff for a while, and then now he's got like the whole, you know, Bezos kind of like stopped the Washington Post from endorsing someone in the presidential election. Now he's making this like $1 million donation to Trump's inauguration campaign. I mean, are you looking at alternatives to, you know, like, I don't know. I don't like how involved I am with Amazon.
I hate being in business with Amazon for all of those reasons, but I also live in the world, and they offer this amazing tool for printing and distributing books that you frankly, there's nothing else, at least that I found, because I believe me, I looked for this reason. I really tried when I first started this, like, do I really have to use Amazon? And what I basically learned at the time, and I don't know if this has changed really since then, is that you don't have to, but you will make, you know, pennies on the dollar compared to what you would make promoting and selling your book on Amazon. So I hate being in business with them, but there's a lot of businesses that I use on a daily basis that I have a lot of issues with in terms of the way they conduct themselves. And unfortunately, we have to live in the world and in this country and make what we can of it. And so I don't love being in business with Amazon at all, but the fact is that they're also very good at what they do. And so it's a pill I'm willing to swallow at this point. But if you ever hear of any way we can go out on our own and avoid working with Amazon, I'm all ears.
Yeah, I will let you know. I've also been not terribly successful on that front. I am working on getting my books available on bookshop.org, which is still, I mean, they're still published through Amazon, but if you tick the like extended distribution thing, you know, those will show up elsewhere. And you might ask, because like mine, my partner actually flagged this for me, but it was only the large print editions of the books that were available on Bookshop. And I did have to kind of like contact, they were very responsive, but I did have to actually like contact them and like share the ISBN numbers with them and stuff. And I guess the ISBNs, the N stands for number, and get them to like manually change something. But there are at least options for people, you know, you can provide options for potential customers who don't want to buy something on Amazon.
Yeah, that's true. You definitely can sell the book other places. And if anyone who wants to contact me directly, I'd be happy to, you know, get them a copy of the book myself. But Amazon is still the publisher, so they're still, you know, they're still making money off
right.
of all these.
I mean,
books,
I think of this the poker analogy is kind of like when you're playing against the big stack at the final table. And like they do get to bully you, you know, like it's not, it feels bad. You're just like folding your big blind. You're like, oh, I know you're raising me with any two cards, but there's nothing I can do about it. And like, I mean, I do think that's kind of the case when it's like, you know, there's behemoths as large as Amazon or individuals as wealthy as Bezos. Like they really do have the power to force you into some situations that you don't like being in, but there's not a lot you can really do about it. And you do it just have to fold to them.
I think it's a really good analogy because what are you going to do? Go in against the big stack? I mean, you can, right. And it might work briefly, but it's not a good play in the long term. So it's it's unfortunate, but I don't want to say I've made peace with it because I haven't, but I have not yet come up with a better solution. And like I said, the fact is that they are extremely good at printing these books on demand, and that to me is worth something. And so. I would love to see the company get sold to someone else and have, you know, better business practices. And I guess, you know, we can kind of hope for that and advocate for that. But until that happens, yeah, I will just be folding my short stack at the final table to the bully and, you know, see what happens. I do appreciate you bringing that up, Andrew, because I think it's a point that doesn't get talked about very much, at least in, especially in like poker discussions.
Well, I appreciate you being receptive to it. There's a lot of people I wouldn't have brought it up with.
Right. And I know that you and I feel similar about these kind of things, and so I appreciate you bringing it up, because it is an important thing to put out there, and a lot of people might not realize some of the issues you were talking about with Amazon. It's not that we just like hate big companies, like full stop. There's some very specific things Amazon has done that you and I, and probably a lot of others, if they knew about them, would not be too happy about.
Well, thanks for talking to us, Matt. Congratulations again on the new book.
Thank you so much, Andrew and Carlos. It's always good to talk to you guys. We'll try to make it a tradition.
Yes, this was a great one.
All right, take care, guys.
Okay, take care. Happy New Year.
Of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't.